why we believe that the Bible alone is God's trustworthy word. I hope that we do all believe that. On the first day, we talked just very briefly about the whole idea of making a defense of apologetics. The idea of a defense is presented to us several times in Scripture. Paul had to defend his faith on a number of occasions. Peter enjoined us all to be ready to defend our faith, to give a reason, to give an apology, to make a defense for the hope that we have within us. And in fact, as believers in the Lord Jesus Christ, there are going to be occasions many and many a time when we need to defend our faith in Jesus, our faith in God, our faith in the Bible as the revealed will of God, our faith in some point of doctrine, some aspect of what we believe. And, you know, the idea of doctrine falls into this realm of apologetics as well, and we'll be touching on a few things that deal with that, including where we left off on Tuesday when we were talking just a little bit about the Da Vinci Code. And maybe I'm going to say more about that than there's any need to. Maybe there's no great thing to address here. But my interest in particular is not in the novel, The Da Vinci Code, but in the fact that in that book, Dan Brown touches on a number of themes that are very much at play in the public media, in the mass media, as far as religion is concerned. There have been TV specials about the book. I have seen comments to the effect that, you know, just everybody's reading it, you get on an airplane, and this is the one book that everybody's carrying. And I made a kind of a point of noticing that when I flew myself in May. I thought, well, I'll just kind of try and pay attention and see whether I see people carrying around the Da Vinci Code in the airport and on the airplane. And as a matter of fact, I did. It wasn't pervasive, it wasn't everywhere, but it certainly was the most common book that I saw people carrying and reading in the airport and on the airplane. The second most common being some kind of pornographic magazine, but the most common particular book that I saw people carrying and reading indeed was the Da Vinci Code when I was flying on America West Airlines in May. So just my own little survey, you know, it wasn't everybody reading it, but lots and lots of people are reading it. There's lots of buzz about it, and that's why it has been brought to play in TV specials. But I also am aware and will point out that this book's going to come out as a movie in the near future. It's in process of being developed as a movie, and there's going to be a movie, The Da Vinci Code. And that will, you know, just kind of highlight the issues that this book brings up all the more. We talked a little bit about the slide that's up right now, about exploring controversial historical questions, but really they're non-historical questions. They're put in the guise of history, but really they're non-historical questions, because there is no historical documentation that lends itself to the kinds of accusations and conspiracies that Dan Brown writes about in this particular book. We looked at this slide also. This was the last thing that we really looked at on Tuesday, where Dan Brown is quoted, and he talks about the fact that many historians now believe, as he does, that engaging the historical accuracy of a given concept, we should first ask ourselves a far deeper question: how historically accurate is history itself? Well, that's fine as far as it goes. We should view everything with somewhat of a jaundiced eye. We should bring an aspect of criticism and discernment into everything that we read, whether new or old. But in that particular quote, he had already said that basically you can't trust history because history is written by the winners, a quote that's going to be coming up again in this particular slide. Mary Magdalene Veiled in Mystery. This is an article that was in the Springfield, Missouri Newsleader. So you don't have to, you know, go to Big City Press to find these kinds of articles, which is part of the point that I want to stress during the lessons these 2 weeks. These are things that are in the public eye, that are very commonly being talked about in the media. The Springfield, Missouri Newsleader. Anne Graham Brock suspects that a struggle between Mary Magdalene and the Apostle Peter may have been the heart of the matter. Wow, Bible has a lot to say about that one, doesn't it? A struggle between Mary Magdalene and Peter. Or those early authors that were trying to help others understand the Christian faith. Only in the Gospel of Luke, who was one of Peter's chief supporters, is it written that Mary Magdalene is not given a commissioning to go and tell the others about the resurrection of Jesus. Is that right? Is that right that only in Luke is Mary not reported as being given a commission to go and tell the others? In Luke, she also is described as being possessed by 7 demons. Well, actually, she's described as having been exorcised of 7 demons, right? That in Luke, in the 8th chapter, the first 3 verses, which is a passage we'll look at shortly, we're told that Jesus had cast 7 demons out of her, which is a little different than Luke saying that she was possessed. she had been, but Jesus had delivered her from that, and he mentions that in a very positive context. What about that Luke was one of Peter's chief supporters? Is that right? Was Luke one of Peter's chief supporters? Luke with Paul. Yeah, I would associate Luke much more with Paul. In fact, Luke does tell us about the early activities that Peter and other apostles were engaged in, but really focusing on Peter in those first 11 and into the 12th chapter of Acts when Peter leaves Jerusalem in the 12th chapter of Acts. He does tell us about some of the early things that Peter was directly involved in, but it's hard for me to read that from the same political perspective that Mary K. Ritz reflects on Anne Graham Brock having as being an indicator that Luke was one of the strong supporters, one of Peter's chief supporters. That really isn't what Luke is writing about, but you can indeed bring this kind of political perspective to historical accounts and then judge them accordingly. History, she notes, is written by the winners, and I really want to emphasize that statement because it has a lot to do with where we are as a culture in this postmodern or post-postmodern era or whatever it is that we're living in right now. The whole idea of truth, of things that can be established as true and that you can continue to believe them over the generations and over the millennia, that idea has largely been discarded. And particularly in institutions of higher education and universities, history is no longer presented in the way that it was a generation ago. It's presented with this kind of perspective that history is written by the winners, that you cannot trust what historians have said, you can't trust the data of the pact. In fact, I think we should view what historians have said with a critical eye. Did they have a political agenda? That's fine to approach history in that way. But this goes beyond that to the point where you don't trust the data, you don't trust the information about the fact, you don't trust much of anything, and then you come to the place where not trusting it, you can simply rewrite it to suit yourself, which is what is going on in the current era, whatever that era may be called. History, she notes, is written by the winners, and the pro-Peter faction called Petrin are winners. When did they become winners? When did this pro-Peter faction become winners? She's kind of talking about the whole development, or at least I think she is, and I'm kind of imposing upon her now and take it as such, but she's kind of talking about the whole development of the papal idea and the see of Peter and passing on the authority of Peter and all that. But was Peter involved in that? Did Peter have anything to do with that? Did the church in the first three centuries have anything to do with that? You see, those kinds of ideas are ideas that come up much, much later and have nothing to do with being pro-Peter or Petrin or anything like that. That's part of why, the last paragraph there, part of why women's leadership diminished, she says. Peter is the spokesman for women's silence, for women to take a second seat. You, knowing the Bible as you do, would you say that Peter is the spokesman for women's silence? Paul is the spokesman for women's silence. Surely it's those passages in Paul that we struggle with in looking at the role of women, women speaking in the church, women taking leadership. It's the passages that Paul wrote. So, you know, take this with an appropriate grain of salt. We had a quotation up there on Tuesday about how Jesus haunts the American culture, but people are biblically illiterate. And so people can, scholars can say pretty nearly anything about Jesus or the New Testament, and people say, well, yeah, I can see how that would be true. But we're standing on very flimsy ground with the kind of assertions that are being made. They're being made based on what amounts to a stack of cards in the first place. What about history? If history is written by the winners, does that matter? Does it matter if, in fact, history is written by the winners? Does that make it true or unreliable? Can we know the truth? That's a basic question that we have to think about in this regard. Can we know the truth? I say yes, we can. We can't know the truth about everything, but we can know the truth about a lot of things. We can indeed find truth and discern what is real and what is not. Is historical knowledge always subjective, or are there objective facts to know and consider? How many people here were alive when that D-Day invasion took place that Steve made reference to in his comments? Raise your hand. Okay, now put your hands down, and how many people were not alive when that D-Day invasion took place? Hey, there are a lot more of us who weren't there. Are you sure you can trust the things these guys are saying about that? You know, are you sure you can believe that that invasion ever really happened? Because that's really where we come to when it comes to this kind of questioning of history and history being written by the winners and so forth. And that's why you have people saying today, this is going to sound like another ad hominem attack on Mel Gibson, but actually it's just one of those flow of thought kind of things. That's why people like Mel Gibson's dad can say that the Holocaust never happened, right? Just deny that those things ever happened in Hitler's Germany and the Europe that he controlled for a few years. Just say that that's all been kind of blown up by people with a political agenda in order to create this sort of mentality, this sort of attitude that favors the power that the Jews have and so on and so on and so on. You can deny history. You don't have to go very far back to do it. You can say, well, these things just never happened. And a lot of people will, in fact, believe you. A lot of people will, in fact, buy into whatever sort of conspiracy theory may be cooked up, whatever sort of political agenda may be ascribed to anyone whatsoever. But historical knowledge is not always subjective. Historical knowledge can be truly known, whether it's from 50, 60 years ago, or 100 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 3,000 years ago. Historical knowledge can be objectively discerned. We can know historical facts and reality. We can sift through the debris and find the truth. And we always have a responsibility to do that. There are always going to be myths that are circulating around us, and part of being on the defense, part of being an apologist for the Christian faith, is being kind of wary about that. I always cringe when my Christian brothers and sisters send me things through email or via the internet that are simply wrong. And I shared that 5 years ago about Madeline Murray O'Hara, and it wasn't too long after the lesson on Madeline Murray O'Hara that her body was finally found as the murder victim that she was. But the idea of just naively buying accusations and innuendo and conspiracy theories and passing them along, either because they seem to favor your Christian perspective or, in the case of some of the Da Vinci adherents, because it seems to undermine the Christian faith, we need to be wary about what we naively accept and pass along. We need to be careful to be sure that we are looking at real information, real data, and passing that and sharing that in an appropriate way. Is history really always or even generally written by the winners? And my answer to that is no. I do not believe that history is always written by the winners. I don't think history is even generally written by the winners. Very often the people who write history have been people who had some sort of an intellectual capacity that the winners didn't necessarily have. And I won't go any further with that. But very often the records of history have been written with people who did not approve of the winners, who did not approve of those who were in the positions of power. We need to always ask, in looking at historical information or any other kind of information, does it pass the test as described in 1 John 4 and 1? Dear friends, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. And that certainly continues to be the case where we stand right now today. Many false prophets have gone out into the world, and we need to be careful what we believe, no matter what the forum in which it's presented. What about Mary? In its book, The Da Vinci Code, Brown claims that the Holy Grail was actually Mary Magdalene. She was the vessel that held the blood of Jesus Christ in her womb while bearing his children. This is from a sort of review of the book by Sandra Meisel in Crisis magazine, and I'm going to have a few quotes that she has about Dan Brown's writing and the allegations that he makes in the book. A lot of people have read this book. I gave it a shot, and I read quite a bit of it, and I skimmed some of it because it wasn't really something that I could get into or enjoy reading. I didn't find it to be a satisfying mystery or thriller or any of those kinds of things. To me, you know, there's just enough violence and sort of sexual innuendo from time to time to kind of move the story along a little bit, but mostly the story is secret driven. Just come on, I'll tell you another secret. Let me tell you another secret. Let me tell you another secret. And that's kind of what moves the story along, and I really grow very quickly bored of things like that, in part because so many of the secrets he's telling are simply not true. And not only the ones that pertain to the church, but even the ones that pertain to ordinary history. He says things about Leonardo da Vinci that are just demonstrably not true. He says things about Isaac Newton that are just easily demonstrated to be untrue. He says things about the behavior of the medieval church that are simply not true. They're gross exaggerations. And he does this again and again and again in the course of the book. And so the analysis of the apostles and Mary and all that is in keeping with his general treatment of history. He just makes it up as he goes along, with occasional references to credible scholars or to people who have their own axe to grind in whatever case. He talks about Da Vinci's Last Supper, the painting that was painted on the wall, a sort of a fresco But Da Vinci, unfortunately, mixed his own paints and didn't use anything that was going to last a whole long time. Eggs were part of the mix. And there's been this big problem of preserving this painting that Da Vinci did of the Last Supper. And most of the images of the Last Supper that you've seen have been, you know, heavily retouched, heavily corrected for the decay and deterioration that's occurred over the years. Just very recently, they have completed a restoration of this painting, an attempt to bring it back to what Da Vinci himself had painted, because in previous efforts, and especially a big effort in the 19th century, a lot of it had really been repainted by others trying to make it look like they thought it was supposed to look. And so they've taken off layers of paint and so on and so forth. Well, the depiction of Jesus at the Last Supper is completely historically inaccurate. You realize that? This is kind of like Mel Gibson's Passion. I mean, there's sort of an outline there, but it's really completely historically inaccurate in the way that he pictured it. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time debunking Da Vinci's perception of it, including the chairs and the whole bit that just weren't part of the scene. But the one thing that I just wanted to point out about it especially is when Da Vinci painted this painting. When did he paint it? It's right there on the top for you to see. Okay, it took him 3 years to paint it. Started in 1495, finished in 1498. I understand he had a little problem finishing projects that he got started. And that had some bearing on how often and how well he got paid. But I can understand that. He was a bit of a procrastinator. He had a tendency to start things and not finish them and put projects off. Took him 3 years to finish this particular project. But the money was good. You know, they were paying him. He was an artist for hire, and most of the works that we're familiar with were commissioned paintings that this man produced. But 1495, how long is that after the Last Supper took place? Now, even supposing there are some cool codes that Da Vinci put into this painting, I'm really mightily impressed about someone 14 and a half centuries after the fact having the scoop that everybody missed, you know, that nobody knew about. The very idea is just, it's ludicrous. It's absurd that there's been a secret passed down from generation to generation, and after 14 and a half centuries, this secret is put on, you know, it's just ludicrous. It's an absurd notion to treat history in such a way. Now, one of the things that Da Vinci did, if you notice the figure over on the right-hand side of the painting with the long hair and the white beard, it's not Butch. Who is that? That's Da Vinci himself. He put himself into the painting as one of the apostles. Okay, that's a self-portrait that Da Vinci put into the painting. And yeah, it's a little faint, and that's all right. The figure to the left of Jesus that's wearing a kind of a red sash and a kind of a bluish garment, who's that? Well, who's it supposed to be? Does anyone know? Who was the one that was asked? Da Vinci says it's Mary Magdalene. Or excuse me. The Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown says it's Mary Magdalene. But in fact, yes, this has been recognized as being John, the apostle whom Jesus loved, who leaned on his breast during the supper, and the one who was told, ask him who he means when Jesus said that one of you is going to betray me. And that's what's going on here, is he's being told, ask who he means. That is, in fact, the apostle John. Now, the depiction of John may be a little bit effeminate. This is the cleaned up version of that picture. People have said that this picture has cleavage, but that's because there's a crack running down the middle of the chest, a crack in the plaster that it's painted on, okay? And if you look at some of Da Vinci's paintings, androgyny is not new in The Last Supper. Dan Brown says that Da Vinci was a flamboyant homosexual and that everybody knew that. In fact, historically, that's not the case at all. Now, Freud, 400 years after the fact, diagnosed Da Vinci as being homosexual, and some of his drawings and some of his paintings would suggest that he may have had a flair for an interest in the male body. That may be the case, but we don't actually know whether he was. We certainly don't know that he was a practicing homosexual, but some of his figures, some of the males that he painted, were painted in a rather androgynous, ambivalent kind of way. But this is the Apostle John, and the clothing is male clothing. There's really no doubt of that this is, in keeping with his other work, male clothing that's pictured there. But according to Da Vinci, this is Mary Magdalene, which means there are only 11 apostles in the picture, according to that. Did I say according to Da Vinci? According to the code, according to Brown, Dan Brown, that would be the case. Yeah, keep me on track there. This is a quote from the book, and I'm spending way more time on this than I really should, but I don't know how to let go of it without saying a few things. The Grail, Langdon said, is symbolic of the lost goddess. When Christianity, Langdon is the protagonist in the book. He's the scholarly protagonist in the story. When Christianity came along, the old pagan religions did not die easily. That much, at least, is true enough. The old pagan religions did not die easily. There was quite a battle fought, and the Christians were on the end of suffering for a long time in that respect. Legends of chivalric quests for the Holy Grail were, in fact, stories of forbidden quests to find the lost sacred feminine. Well, this is simply nonsense, but nevertheless, it's put forth as a major thesis of the book. Knights who claimed to be searching for the chalice were speaking in code as a way to protect themselves from a church that had subjugated women, banished the goddess, burned non-believers, and forbidden the pagan reverence for the sacred feminine. Well, first of all, is that church the New Testament church? It's certainly not. Nevertheless, this is part of what we have to take into consideration when we're talking to unbelievers, and in fact, when we're talking to people who have some sort of mixed background, some faith, but don't have all the information sorted out. We have to understand that there is a history of the church that has nothing to do with the church that Jesus founded, except that it has stood very often in striking opposition to the church that Jesus founded. But when we read in novels, and I've read a lot of fantasy novels years ago that were very hostile toward the church as it is perceived. It's a theme, it's a thread that comes up often in that particular genre, that there is a perception that when you say the church and you're talking about medieval Roman Catholicism, that you're talking about the Christian faith. And we need to be able to make a distinction in that regard. We need to certainly know ourselves that there's a distinction between New Testament Christian faith and the faith of the Middle Ages Roman Catholic Church and the things that were going on there. Nevertheless, he casts this in a completely untrue light in talking about this sort of conflict between the masculine and the feminine, between the masculine-driven church and the feminine-driven paganism. In fact, what did Roman Catholicism do to embrace the feminine, to bring a feminine figure into the quest for the divine? Mother Mary, right, who becomes effectively the Queen of Heaven in terms of a lot of the liturgy and the practice associated with her in medieval Catholicism. Far from rejecting the sacred feminine, they embraced it in the form of the things that were taught and presented about Mary and the praying to Mary and the reverence for Mary, which is still very much in play in Roman Catholicism today. And by the way, taking a little side trip to Mel Gibson's movie again, why did Mel Gibson have Mary, the mother of Jesus, so prominently on display throughout that movie? He said himself, this is a very Marian movie that he had made. He is very, very strongly into the adoration of Mary and really wanted to promote that, putting Mary in places where the Gospels simply do not place her and giving her a role that is no part of the New Testament story of the suffering of Christ. In fact, Mel Gibson had both Marys there, didn't he? He had not only Mary, the mother of Jesus, but he also had Mary Magdalene very prominently on screen in a number of places where she had no biblical basis, no historical basis for her presence being there. Brown, going back to Sandra Meisel's comments on Brown's Da Vinci Code, Brown isn't so much writing badly as writing in a particular way best calculated to attract a female audience. I don't know if that's offensive or not, but since a woman wrote it, I thought I could go ahead and use it. Women, after all, buy most of the nation's books. He has married a thriller plot to a romance novel technique. And I think that's actually a pretty fair description of what he has done as far as the mechanics of the novel that he's written, is that it has a lot in common with romance books, but with some of the plot elements of a thriller. And then again, commenting on Dan Brown, a writer who thinks the Merovingians founded Paris and forgets that the popes once lived in Avignon is hardly a model researcher. And that is absolutely correct. My father-in-law read this book, and we visited him in June, and he's, never mind. But he was very excited about it. This is the best book he has read in years, and he just kept turning the pages, and he had to read everything else that Dan Brown had written, which ended up being a big letdown. He just had to read all this, and he said to me, this man is such a meticulous researcher and such a careful historian. And I said, no, he's not. He is not at all. Now, if you don't bother to either already know or check some of the things that he says, you might easily believe that he is, because he throws out names and facts and dates and information just helter-skelter, but an awful lot of it is just plain made up. And even though they are names of real people in most cases, they have no connection with the reality of what we know historically about the times and places and character and events. For him to state that the church burned 5 million women. And that, when I came across that particular statement myself, I had to stop and say, that makes no sense at all. 5 million women. Can you imagine the effect that would have had on Europe if they had burned 5 million women at the stake? Medieval Europe, the population of the time. But he states that the church burned 5 million women as witches. And this shows a willful and malicious... We had a quote from Proverbs about malicious liars, and this was one of the reasons I had that quote. Willful and malicious ignorance of the historical record. The latest figures for deaths during the European witch craze are between 30 to 50,000 victims. Now, that's a lot of people, okay? And don't downplay that. That's a lot of people. But there is a lot of difference over a period of 350 years between putting to death 30 to 50,000 people and 5 million people. And the number 5 million is intended as a shocker. I mean, look how bad the Christian faith is in its suppression of opposition. The idea, I think I better, Butch. I'm getting a couple of offers of water here, and thank you. Brown's claim that educated women, priestesses, and midwives were singled out by witch hunters is not only false, it betrays his goddess-friendly sources. And again, this is very much in play in the world in which we currently live. The whole idea not only of mysticism, not only of the revival of, you know, in New Age and so forth, but also of the revival of witchcraft in the broad sense, and the sacred feminine and so forth. Now, it so happens that I looked at a goddess-friendly source myself in researching and thinking about this topic that had to do with the witch hunts that took place in medieval Europe from about the 14th to the early 18th century, and a little bit of what happened in America during that time frame. And as that particular author on a Wiccan page, a witchcraft page, as that particular author tried to describe in some fairly unbiased and accurate ways, she talked about the number being perhaps 50,000. And she said, but these were by no means all put to death by the church. A lot of this was by secular government figures. A lot of this was by people who just had a grudge against someone else. And she says that the hands of witches themselves were not clean. And she points out that during that time, there was just a general acceptance of the idea of sorcery and witchcraft in Europe. And that you had people who were regarded as black witches, bad witches, and white witches, good witches. And people would go to someone they considered a practitioner of white arts and say, you know, I think someone put a curse on me. And this person would say, well, yes, someone did put a curse on you. And once they had named that person was in a lot of trouble. That person was in a real difficult position, and some of those people were put to death because of those accusations, made not by priests, not by members of the Inquisition, but rather by others who had a reputation for witchcraft themselves. So it's a very mixed bag, and it's a cultural phenomenon that's a little bit hard to understand. But human nature sometimes goes off in directions that are very intolerant, and it has really very little to do with the teachings of the New Testament once again. But Brown nevertheless claims that educated women, priestesses, and midwives were singled out by the witch hunters, which is unmitigatingly false. That's absolutely false if that was the case. But his idea again is that women have been suppressed, historically suppressed, by the followers of Jesus, which is how he views it. Worst of all, in Brown's eyes, is the fact that the pleasure-hating, sex-hating, woman-hating church suppressed goddess worship and eliminated the divine feminine. He claims that goddess worship universally dominated pre-Christian paganism with the hieros gamos. That's a sacred prostitution, really, when you get right down to it, which we find elements of that occurring among the Israelites in the Old Testament. The diatribes against the prostitution that was taking place at the high places, which was in the context of fertility rites and the worship of Canaanite gods. In fact, though, recognizing that goddess worship was a factor in paganism, goddesses did not dominate the pre-Christian world. This is about like that book I shared with you the other day where the writer said that monotheism was responsible for the violence in the world. That's just simply nonsense. And this is a nonsense kind of assertion too. Women did not have a good position under paganism, under polytheism. Women did not enjoy special rights under the polytheism of the Romans or the Greeks or the Egyptians or any of those ancient cultures that you would care to talk about. Goddesses did not dominate the pre-Christian world. Quite the contrary. They put women in the position of being sex objects more than anything else. not in the religions of Rome, her barbarian subjects, Egypt, or even Semitic lands where the hieros gamos was an ancient practice. It's a complete misrepresentation of what we do actually know historically. Now this is from an article called Who Was Mary Magdalene in the Christian Science Monitor. Over the past 15 years, a stream of books have appeared about Mary Magdalene by feminist theologians seeking a heritage for women within the church. Do women need to find a heritage within the church? Isn't this a strange place that we have come to culturally, that women don't have a heritage in the church, that women need to find a heritage in the church, that women have been so demeaned and degraded and devalued by the church that they have no place within it? And yet, I think some of us, and especially maybe those who have been educated in more recent times, have some of that kind of sense, that women need to be given a heritage in the church. Meanwhile, new books on the Gnostic Gospels have captured public interest. Elaine Pagel's recent Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, has been a bestseller. And we could talk about the Gnostics, and we could talk about the Gospel of Thomas and the Nag Hammadi books, but I don't want to take the time to do that today. I just want to think with you for a few minutes on this particular topic about Mary. And here I'm talking about Mary Magdalene. What do we know about Mary, Mary Magdalene? Well, if you were around in about 1970 when Jesus Christ Superstar came out, the idea was there that, hey, Mary was romantically interested in Jesus, and Jesus was conflicted about that because he found her attractive, but he had these other goals and other agendas. So this isn't a brand new idea. It's been around for a little while. It doesn't go back to the first century or the second century or the third century or the fourth century, but it's been around for a little while anyway. In Luke chapter 8, 1 through 3, Jesus was traveling around from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him, and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Mary, called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out. Joanna, the wife of Cusa, the manager of Herod's household. Susanna, and many others. These women were helping to support them out of their own means. What's that tell us about Mary? Well, she was a disciple of Jesus. She had at one time had 7 demons. She was generous with her resources and a loyal follower who tried to facilitate the work that Jesus was doing. It also tells us where she was from, right? Because that's what that last name means. She was Mary from Magdala, a city on the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. Mary from Magdala, that's where the Magdalene comes from. The next time that we encounter Mary is in Matthew 27, 55, and 56, when Jesus has been crucified. Many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Well, that's consistent with what Luke said she was doing during his ministry. They had followed him from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. James and Joseph and Zebedee's sons, those were grown men, right? So she's hanging around with women who are the mothers of grown men. I just want to mention that in passing. Matthew 27, verses 59 through 61, this is the burial of Jesus. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. So she was an observer of the crucifixion. She saw the death of Jesus. She was also an observer of the burial of Jesus. She saw him buried. Matthew 28, this is a lengthier passage, and I'm not going to read the entire passage, but verse 1, after the Sabbath at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. She knew where he was buried. She'd seen it happen. She went to the tomb with the desire to take care of his body, which had not received adequate pre-burial care as the Sabbath was coming on. So we have a description of an angel descending, a violent earthquake, the stone being rolled away, the guards becoming like dead men. And then in verse 5, the angel said to the women, okay, this is Mary and Mary, the women, do not be afraid, for I know that you're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He's not here. He has risen just as he said. They're invited to see where he was buried, and then they are told that he's going ahead of them to Galilee, and there you will find him. I have told you. So the women in verse 8 hurried from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them. So Mary is now a witness of the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus. She is a witness of the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus. Greetings, he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. Now, Mary is not a solo witness of any of these things. In every one of these instances, she has had other female companions that she was with. Then Jesus said to him, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me. Now, that really is the sum total of what we have about Mary Magdalene, but we do have the same incidents reported in somewhat different perspectives in the other Gospels. Mark chapter 16, 9 through 11, when Jesus rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene. Was she alone at the time?
No.
Not in Matthew's account. In Matthew's account, the other Mary was there too. And I take that to be the same meeting. I don't know absolutely for sure that that was the same meeting, but I take that to be the same meeting. He appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had driven seven demons. She went and told those who had been with him and who were mourning and weeping. When they heard that Jesus was alive and that she'd seen him, they did not believe it. Notice Mark also mentions that she had been relieved of the seven demons that had been in her. John chapter 20, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple. Did she come to the tomb alone, though? See, John's emphasizing Mary's experience here, and that's very much in keeping with the way that gospel is presented. He's emphasizing her eyewitness experience, but Matthew tells us she wasn't alone at that time. But what John reports to us is accurate. It just doesn't tell us those other details of the story. She came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb. We don't know where they put him." Then further down in that chapter, after the disciples, Peter and John, have come and looked at the tomb, don't know what to make of it, verse 11, Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been. This is a lot of coming and going at the tomb on that particular morning, but this is an outstanding event in the history of the cosmos. And the angels and humans involved all are being brought into the picture with all the powerful things that God is doing. The angels asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" And she said, "They've taken my Lord away." Okay, they've taken my Lord away. I don't know where they put him. At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me." Do you see these as really strong terms of romantic endearment that she's using when she speaks of him and speaks to him? They're terms of respect and admiration and perhaps of affection as well, but that there's no hint of romance in the accounting of this story. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet returned to the Father." In Matthew's account, there were the two Marys when Jesus appeared to them, and they clasped his feet. Here, Mary is told, "Do not hold on to me, for I am returning to my God and your God, my Father and your Father, my God and your God." He tells her, "Go instead to my brothers and tell them that he's going to do that." And Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news. And that's the end of the story of Mary Magdalene. We have read everything that the New Testament has to say about Mary Magdalene, all the times that her name occurred in the scriptures. Now, what kind of historical questions are raised there? Well, I don't actually have a clue of any particular questions being raised there. Her name comes up 12 times in the New Testament. From the 12 passages that mention Mary Magdalene in the New Testament, we know she was a devoted disciple of Jesus from Magdala in Galilee. We know she and several other women often traveled with Jesus and the 12 and helped support his ministry financially. We know Jesus had cast seven demons out of her. We know she was a witness of the death and burial and the resurrection of Jesus. And we know that Jesus told her and other women to go and tell his disciples he was risen and would meet with them. Now, there's a fairly early reference, I think it's in the 3rd century, to Mary Magdalene being an apostle to the apostles. What did that mean? It means what we just read. Jesus said, "Go tell my disciples," because an apostle is someone who's sent. Go tell my disciples. That's what the writer was talking about, is that she was sent to tell the disciples that this stuff was real. Jesus had risen from the dead. But we don't know anything about her age. How was she pictured in the Passion? Anyone know? Beautiful young model. Her name was Bellucci. Bellucci, right? Anyway, Mel Gibson chose an attractive model to play Mary Magdalene. How is she typically pictured in paintings from the Middle Ages? Young and attractive, okay? But do we know that about Mary? Was she young? She hung around with women who were middle-aged and older, but she could have been young, but she certainly didn't have to be young. We don't have a clue about how old Mary was or whether she was attractive. There's no suggestion about that. Yes, Catherine?
The financial
No, it doesn't. It suggests, in fact, that either she might have been a widow or in some other way a recipient of largesse. Repeat what she said? All right, her financial independence does not suggest that she was a young, unattached woman. All right. We don't know whether she was romantically interested in Jesus or anyone else. We don't know whether she stayed in Jerusalem after the resurrection or whether she returned to Galilee. We don't know whether she traveled far. We don't know when or where she died. It seems likely that Mary, the devoted disciple and the supporter of Jesus, though, would be appalled at the use and abuse of her name and character by postmodern interpreters with anti-biblical agendas. I don't think Mary would be thrilled at all with the Da Vinci Code and other writings, and there is a plethora of writings that capitalize on the ignorance, what we don't know about Mary Magdalene, turning her into a figure that she was never presented as being, either in the Gospels or in any of the early accounts of the things that the church was doing and the way business was being conducted. It's not a big shocker. A couple of years ago, the Southern Baptist Convention came together and they issued in their statement of doctrine that a woman, and they did this in explicit intention to restate for the members of their group a support for what Paul writes in Ephesians 5:22 and following, that a woman should respectfully submit to her husband. You remember the news accounts about that just a couple years ago, that the Baptists had declared that wives ought to submit to their husbands, and what an outrageous thing that was. Well, that's the kind of environment that this particular book is catering to, and that we really need to be at least aware of and understand a little bit of the kind of political attitude that exists out there. One other thing I'm going to mention about the Da Vinci Code before I completely leave it behind and start on today's lesson for the next 10 minutes is that the female protagonist in that book is called Sophie Nouveau. Okay, Sophie Nouveau. Now, one of the things that Dan Brown plays games with is etymology, and he almost never uses appropriate etymology. It's stuff that just doesn't work at all when he talks about the background of words in terms of the Christian faith and in terms of the Holy Grail and a few other times. He talks about Jehovah in a way that demonstrates complete ignorance of how that term came about. Again, using it, twisting it to the idea of the feminist perspective that he's really endorsing here. But his etymologies are seldom correct. But he calls his female protagonist Sophie Nouveau, and there's no accident in that. There's just a tiny bit of linguistic cleverness, if that's what that is. That name Sophie comes from the 8th chapter of Proverbs in the Greek language, the word Sophia, which is the word for what? What's being presented to us in the 8th chapter of Proverbs? Wisdom. Okay, wisdom is presented there in the feminine, and how wisdom was there with God at the beginning when everything was created, and how wisdom had her part in the organizing of the created world that we live in, and she's at God's right hand. And feminist theologians in the 1990s really fastened on that idea of Sophia as the divine feminine. Sophia is the divine feminine. And the Nouveau, the rest of this character's name, is new. This is new wisdom. This is the new divine feminine that this author is talking about. The code doesn't run very deep at all, but that's what he's talking about. Well, let's think a little bit more about religion in the marketplace, because that's where that novel is. It's in the marketplace. Religion in the marketplace. The Complete Idiot's Guide to the Bible. Do you find that disturbing? I don't actually find that disturbing at all. I don't have any problem with the Complete Idiot's Guide to the Bible. I do have a little problem with the fact that it's not bent to the left like it's supposed to be, because that's going to mess up some things a little further along. But that has to do with the presentation and the technology, not the fact. There's an idiot's guide to just about everything, isn't there? The dummy's guides, the idiot's guides, there's a whole plethora of these. And I've looked at this, and it's not especially bad. It's no worse than a lot of other books that are out in the marketplace right now that serve as introductory guides to the Bible. I don't agree with the take on the Bible. These men don't necessarily think the Bible is the immutable Word of God, as we're talking about here, but then a lot of other authors don't either. And so it's just right in the vein of what is being published in mainstream press about the Bible these days. But I do think it's kind of interesting that the same company in publishing its literature, like I said, publishes just about everything, right? Not only do we have the Idiot's Guide to the Bible, we also have the Idiot's Guide to Wicca and Witchcraft and to Buddhism and to whatever else you'd care to think about. The Idiot's Guide to all these things, which is to say all these things are on a kind of a level playing field out there in the marketplace. They're all pretty much the same thing if you can make a buck off of them. And so don't expect to find in published literature today the same kind of outlook on the Bible that you might have found a few years ago, several years ago, with the big Bible houses that were publishing all the literature. The literature is being published by people, including the big Bible houses, that belong to bigger corporate structures. The literature is being published by people who are looking for one outcome. Money. That's right. It is the marketplace. Religion in the marketplace. We could talk about the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, or we can talk about the Habits of Highly Effective Churches by George Barna. And we're not particularly talking about different things when all is said and done. We're talking about the product of research. We're talking about the product of observation and experience. We're not talking about the product of biblical information. We're talking about what people conclude based on examining what works. Now, is that a good criterion for arriving at religious conclusion, doing what works? I hope we realize that's not a good criterion at all for forming the basic conclusions of our lives about how religion ought to be conducted and put into practice the belief system that we ought to embrace. It's not about what works, it's about what's right. I would hope that we understand that it's not a question of what works, it's a question of what's right, because what works very often has little to do with what's right. George Barna, in his book, The Habits of Highly Effective Churches, and we're talking again about religion in the marketplace, provides a this is not my analysis, this is on his website, okay? This is what he says about his own book, or what his marketers say about his book. George Barna, and he, by the way, is the Gallup of religious polling. The Barna poll is to religious polling what the Gallup poll is to more secular political types of polls. George Barna provides a tour de force of insight into what makes the church highly effective in America. This presentation focuses upon 9 key emphases of the most effective churches in the country related to leadership development, organization, relationships, worship, evangelism, theological education, stewardship, community service, and family ministry. Barna will help you discover how to enable your church to become more effective in ministry without compromising the gospel. Notice that last phrase, without compromising the gospel. These methods will work no matter what your doctrine is. I'm going to revisit that. George Barna also has a book, How to Increase Giving in Your Church. And see, if you don't find that automatically appalling, then you need to go back and revisit the New Testament. You really need to spend a little more time there. How to Increase Giving in Your Church, a practical guide to the sensitive task of raising money for your church or ministry. This is religion in the marketplace. George Barna is not a particularly bad guy. That's not my point. In the again, this is from his website. In the competitive market for people's donations, you cannot assume that just because someone attends your church, they will support it financially. In this well-researched study of donation habits in congregations, Barna describes the 6 major motivations for donating, the best practices of the best-funded churches in America, and the practical and biblical approach to raising ministry funds. Well, I'm glad we got a biblical approach in there at the end. But this is about experience. It's about what works. It's about what's testable and provable in a very humanistic frame of reference. And an awful lot of religion in the marketplace is in that vein. We talked about eyewitness testimony on our first day. Here's a passage from Hebrews 2, 1 through 4. We must pay more careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard so that we do not drift away. Does the shipwreck come, you know, just like that? No. You kind of drift into it. You just kind of slip along into it. So that we do not drift away. For if the message spoken by angels was binding, and that means the old covenant law of Moses, the angels that dealt with Moses at Sinai and in the burning bush, if the message spoken by angels was binding and every violation and disobedience received its just punishment, how shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation? This salvation, which was first announced by the Lord, was confirmed to us by those who heard him, that is to say, the eyewitnesses. God also testified to it by signs, wonders, and various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to his will. And this was written before the destruction of Jerusalem, and a lot of the people reading this would have already seen signs and wonders from various people who were endowed by the Holy Spirit. But what was their agenda? What was the eyewitness agenda? Was it fundraising? Was it even building more effective churches? Telling the story that does what? Saves people. That saves people. Salvation. That was their agenda, to save people. Now, this is going on a bit of a side trip, but bear with me. Woman in hospital after being mauled. Victim loses eye to attack by mountain lion during hike north of Kernville. In fact, she was hiking on a trail that my sons and I went on for a couple of nights last summer in June. We hiked this particular trail. So that kind of caught my eye a little bit more. But This woman was attacked by a mountain lion on this trail in Kern County, north of Kernville. And the article tells us that there were 15 recorded mountain lion attacks since 1890. Since 1890, right? The facts are true. 15 recorded mountain lion attacks since 1890. Therefore, mountain lion attacks are very rare. I can remember again and again in my lifetime being told, you know, mountain lion attacks, they just don't happen. Why there haven't been any since thus and so. And the same data is still being thrown out there, but something has changed. If you can make out the column from the side about mountain lion attacks, verified mountain lion attacks in California. June 1890, there was a fatal attack. June 1909, two people died, but they died from rabies after a mountain lion attack. The next one is in March 1986. So we take three out of the 15 since 1890, and we have 12 since 1986, 12 mountain lion attacks since 1986 in California, okay? Are they really all that rare? In fact, there have been three this year. So how rare are they? But when you state the fact there have only been 15 recorded mountain lion attacks since 1890, well, that's 115 years. Obviously, they hardly ever happen. But when you say there have been three of them in the past 6 months, that puts a little different spin on the data, doesn't it? Three of those 15 have been in the last 6 months. People have agendas in terms of the way they report facts. That's kind of what Dan Brown was saying, but not exactly, when he was talking about people having agendas and history. You got to look at it with a critical eye. He didn't say that, I say that. You do have to look at the way facts are reported and try and understand what's really being said, especially in our current survey-driven political climate and political in the sense of religion as well as the national politics. 15 recorded mountain lion attacks since 1890, but 12 recorded since 1986, and three so far this year. For the first two-thirds of the 20th century, California's mountain lion population was estimated at not more than 600 animals. Today, the estimate is over 6,000. Clearly, the scene has changed, and those old numbers don't have any relevance to the current scene. And human populations have moved into areas that they weren't living in 30 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years ago. The data has to be understood in its proper context, and that is the case of all the data that we're inundated with in our daily lives. You got to take context into consideration. So test, approve, and find out. And that's where we'll start again on this tomorrow. Test, approve, and find out. Romans 12:2. That'll be our starting point for tomorrow's lesson in this class.